there, all because Miss Rachel shared the post and spoke about it, because she touches a crowd of people that never once knew about these Palestinian children, everything that they're going through.
Can I please give Tariq some love back? Tariq, you're become such a dear friend, and Tariq is one of the helpers that Mr. Rogers was talking about, and I'll text Tariq a baby, and he's a full-time medical student, and he'll text back right away, and he'll find the child, and he's my hero, and he texts me pictures of him and his cats, which I enjoy, and you've become such a dear friend, and Tariq's actually going to be on our show with Rahaf, and Tariq's, I talk about how he's my friend, and he talks about how he's always wanted to be a doctor, and because he wants to help others, and Tariq's just amazing, and I love you, Tariq. Sorry.
We have to break, but we're going to come back to this conversation. Tariq Haylott is with us, director of the Treatment Abroad Program for the Palestine Children's Relief Fund. And for those children who are listening, you don't need me to say that Ms. Rachel is on with us because you recognize her. But yes, we're joined by Rachel Griffin Accorso, a.k.a. Ms. Rachel. I also want to ask, when we come back, the two of you, about children in the rubble in Gaza watching Ms. Rachel, and also what it was like to have Rahaf be in the studio for her as you were dancing and sleeping together, and how she did that. Was she actually nervous as she stood there and danced on her two prosthetics? This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. One day.
Roger Waters, yep, Pink Floyd, performing We Shall Overcome, accompanied by a young Alexander Rowatin on cello in our Democracy Now! Studio years ago. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York. Juan Gonzalez is in Chicago. We're continuing our conversation with Ms. Rachel, the children's entertainer and educator who's become a worldwide sensation over the past 6 years. In March, Ms. Rachel posted a video of two children watching one of her videos. That's not unusual at all, most places in the world. But this was watching one of her videos in the rubble of Gaza. The caption read, "My friends Celine and Celia, in what used to be their home in Gaza, they deserve to live in a warm, safe home again." Ms. Rachel is still with us, along with Tariq Haylott, medical student and director of the Treatment Abroad Program for the Palestine Children's Relief Fund. Talk about that video, Ms. Rachel.
Oh, Celine and Zila are so precious. I've gotten to know many families, and I just wish that our leaders got to know these families and sat with them as well. Seeing them smile and feel a little bit of joy in the midst of unimaginable suffering, it's such an honor to be their friend. And it's just unbelievable.
And Tariq, before the break, you were talking, you are Palestinian. Talk about her effect in Gaza. Talk more about that, what it means for kids to be sitting in the rubble and watching video of Ms. Rachel.
I think it's the fact that they feel seen. more than anything. I mean, I think this is, you know, you were talking about one of the revolutionary moments. I think this episode will be one of those revolutionary moments, because Rahaf's mother would tell me all the time, never in my wildest dream did I ever imagine that Rahaf is going to be on an episode with Miss Rachel. I mean, you have to understand that they have lived in a blockade for God knows how long now. Never did they ever imagine to come to the United States, let alone to be on an episode with their hero, right? So I think that is probably one of the most important things, is for the first time ever, these children truly feel seen on a large scale. And that is what Ms. Rachel's platform is providing for these children.
And Rachel, you posted a quote from James Baldwin on social media that said, quote, "The children are always ours, every single one of them, all over the globe. And I'm beginning to suspect that whoever is incapable of recognizing this may be incapable of morality." Do you sometimes lose hope that our leaders in the West are incapable of morality?
You know, I do have moments where I lose hope, to be honest. But it's really what brings me back to hope is another beautiful quote, and that one I hold dear all the time. I can't remember who it's by, but it says that we have to hold on to hope for the children in these situations, and we have to keep speaking out, and we have to hold on to hope, because we have everything right now, and they have nothing. So it's our responsibility.
Ms. Rachel, can you talk about how other celebrities have responded? Start there. You have said that you don't want to work with people who don't speak out on Gaza. And can you talk about people changing, if you feel that people are changing and more willing?
I do think things are changing. And I think that it's really important for celebrities and leaders to know that you can handle some criticism for saving human lives, and that nothing is more precious than their lives. And the criticism, I think that there's a narrative that there's so much criticism and not support, but there's so much support. I have had so many people come up to me from all walks of life and start crying about these kids. And I think leaders think, oh, you're not connected to Palestinian people and Gaza. And it's what's true is we are connected to them, and you're not connected to us. You're not hearing us, that we want to feed children, and we want children to have education, and we know it's just the right thing to do to help children, but it also serves everyone, and it serves our children. We know that because of research, that when you take care of children and they have education, they're going to become happier, healthier adults in societies. And so I just think it's so important that we take care of the world's children. And I think it's such a huge failing of us adults that we're not.
You're often doing social media, for example, on the children of Sudan. We just did in our headlines the effect on children, the horror there. And then also just how you got your start. Now, who is Miss Rachel?
Oh, my heart breaks every day for Sudan. And I actually, one of my first things I ever did was work teaching music with Sudanese and Somali refugee children in Maine. And they actually inspired me to become a music teacher. And I did some work with kids with disabilities, and I worked at daycares, and I worked at schools. And so for 20 years, working with so many different kids, and kids give us so much. I mean, I went in, I'm going to help kids, and they transform you. Service to others transforms you, and it brings you lasting joy. And it's really what matters. And so I just love kids, and I see them all as equal and wonderful. And I just wish everyone did. And I hope things change soon.
And talk about how you got your start.
I started at a preschool for kids with disabilities, and then I worked with with the kids at the Boys and Girls Club. And then, do you mean the start of the show or the start of
how you got your start and just doing the show from a couple people watching to over a billion?
I was inspired by my amazing little boy, who's him and my little baby Susie are my world. And I would stay up till 2 a.m. learning about speech to try and help my little guy with a severe speech delay. And I think, as we've talked about in this program today, that as a mom, when you see your child struggling, you'll do anything. Go moms. So I learned so much about development and speech and milestones. And then I was looking for a program for him and that I couldn't find. So my husband has a very extensive Broadway background in composing, and we joined together to create something that would meet some of the needs that we weren't seeing met.
And Tarek, I wanted to ask you whether you feel that after this long continued genocide by the Israelis in Gaza, that you feel that we're reaching a turning point, especially after that massive protest, hundreds of thousands of people in Australia in the pouring rain, and now one country after another, even in the West, beginning to recognize the Palestinian state and demand the end to the genocide. Do you feel that we're finally reaching a turning point in this conflict?
I do. And I say that with a lot of reflection on the past, because one of the biggest missions that we've had at PCRF and with the Treatment Abroad program was that we didn't just want to evacuate children to the United States. We wanted to globalize it, and we wanted to open up new pathways. And we wanted to do it in a humanitarian way. And so we said that our mission was to try to convince these governments to open up their borders to receive children, to receive medical care in those countries. And countries such as Britain, Australia, Canada, we were able to convince to open up their borders to take in the first few children from Gaza. And I'm so thankful, because now it's opened up these pathways for other organizations to also evacuate children. I just saw that another child was just recently evacuated to Britain. But yes, I do feel like the tide is shifting. I think Rachel has been a really, really big part of that. And I genuinely mean this, because the narrative is beginning to change. New people are beginning to hear about what's happening. More voices are starting to speak on the subject. More celebrities are starting to see that joining this cause is not going to be detrimental to your reputation, but in fact, not speaking up on what's happening is what's most likely going to be detrimental on your reputation in the future, and how our children and grandchildren see these celebrities. So yes, in short.
We have 30 seconds. Ms. Rachel, your final thoughts. You can share them with children around the world, with their parents, with humanity.
Well, quickly, I want to say that I'm so relieved that people are starting to talk about the starvation of this population. And I just want to honor the 18,000 children that have been killed, because it should have been so much. It should have been like these children mattered, and they're not just numbers. They're 18,000 precious children, and they were everyone's universe, as a Jewish text says. So they were somebody's whole world and somebody's whole universe. And I just want to say to the kids, hi, I'm so proud of you. You have great ideas and a brilliant mind and a wonderful heart, and you're so kind, and you're welcome, and I adore you.
Rachel Griffin Accorso, known as Ms. Rachel, to millions of children around the world who watch her videos and listen to her songs. The Washington Post calls her the Mr. Rogers of her era. She has 16 million subscribers, more than 10 billion views, one of the most popular people on Netflix. Thanks also to Tara Kelat, director of the Treatment Abroad program for the Palestine Children's Relief Fund. Coming up, readings from Howard Zinn's Voices of a People's History of the United States. Stay with us.
There is power in a factory, power in the land, power in the hand of the worker. But it it all amounts to nothing if together we don't stand. There is power in a union. Now the lessons of the past were all learned with workers' blood. The mistakes of the bosses we must pay for. From the cities and the farmlands to trenches full of mud. War has always been the boss's way, sir. The union forever defending our rights. Down with the blackleg, all workers unite. With our brothers and our sisters, together we will stand. There is power in a union. Now I long for the morning that they realize brutality and unjust laws cannot defeat us. Who'll defend the workers?
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. To mark Labor Day, we end today's holiday special with highlights from a production of Howard Zinn's Voices of a People's History of the United States. Dramatic readings from history selected by the late great historian Howard Zinn. We'll hear Alfre Woodard read the words of the labor activist Mother Jones. Howard's son, Jeff Zinn, read the words of an IWW poet and organizer. Marissa Tomei reads the words of the woman suffrage leader Harriet Hansen. But first, the late great actor James Earl Jones reads from Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States.
My viewpoint in telling the history of the United States is that we must not accept the memory of states as our own. Nations are not communities and never have been. The history of any country, presented as the history of a family, conceals a fierce conflict of interest. And in such a world of conflict, a world of victims and executioners, the job of thinking people, as Albert Camus suggested, is not to be on the side of the executioners. Thus, in that inevitable taking of sides, which comes from selection and emphasis in history, I prefer to tell the story of the discovery of America from the viewpoint of the Arawaks, of the Constitution from the standpoint of the slaves, of the rise of industrialism as seen by the young women in the Lowell textile mills, the conquest of the Philippines as seen by black soldiers on Luzon, the post-war American empire as seen by peons in Latin America, and so on, to the limited extent that any one person, however he or she strains, can see history from the standpoint of others. My point is not to grieve for the victims and denounce the executioners. Those tears, that anger cast into the past, deplete our moral energy for the present. And the lines are not always clear. In the long run, the oppressor is also a victim. In the short run, the victims themselves, desperate and tainted with the culture that oppresses them, turn on other victims. Still, understanding the complexities, this book will be skeptical of governments and their attempts through politics and culture to ensnare ordinary people in a giant web of nationhood pretending to a common interest. I will try not to overlook the cruelties that victims inflict on one another as they are jammed together in the boxcars of the system. I don't want to romanticize them, but I do remember, in rough paraphrase, a statement I once heard. The cry of the poor is not always just, but if you don't listen to it, you will never know what justice is.
This is the late historian Howard Zinn.
What is too often overlooked in a triumphal story of the growth of American industry in the 19th century is the human cost of that triumph, the lives cut short, the maimed bodies of the men and women who worked in the factories, the mills. In the Lowell, Massachusetts textile mills of 1836, where girls went to work at the age of 12 and often died by the time they were 25, one of the first strikes of mill girls took place. It is described by one of them, Harriet Hansen.
Read by Marissa Tomei.
When it was announced that wages were to be cut down, great indignation was felt, and it was decided to strike en masse. This was done. The mills were shut down, and the girls went in procession from their several corporations to the Grove on Chapel Hill and listened to incendiary speeches. One of the girls stood on a pump and gave vent to the feelings of her companions in a neat speech, declaring that it was their duty to resist all attempts at cutting down the wages. This was the first time a woman had spoken in public in Lowell, and the event caused surprise and consternation amongst her audience. My own recollection of this first strike, or turnout as it was called, is very vivid. I worked in a lower room where I had heard the proposed strike fully, if not vehemently, discussed. I had been an ardent listener to what was said against this attempt at oppression on the part of the corporation, and naturally I took side with the strikers. When the day came on which the girls were to turn out, those in the upper room started first, and so many of them left that our mill was at once shut down. Then, when the girls in my room stood irresolute, uncertain what to do, asking each other, "Would you or shall we turn out?" and not one of them having the courage to lead off, I, who began to think they would not go out after all their talk, became impatient and started on ahead, saying with childish bravado, "I don't care what you do, I am going to turn out, whether anyone else does or not." And I marched out and was followed by the others. As I looked back at the long line that followed me, I was more proud than I have ever been at any success I may have achieved.
The IWW, Industrial Workers of the World, was a radical labor organization of the early 20th century. It organized all workers, black, white, men, women, native-born, foreign, skilled, unskilled, which the American Federation of Labor refused to do. Its goal was revolutionary, to take over the industrial system and run it for the benefit of the people. When immigrant women in the textile mills in Lawrence, Massachusetts, went on strike in 1912, they were met with police violence and judicial intimidation. The IWW poet and organizer, Arturo Giovannitti, was arrested on spurious charges for murder. Here is his speech to the jury, which found him innocent.
Mr. Foreman and gentlemen of the jury, it is the first time in my life that I speak publicly in your wonderful language, and it is the most solemn moment in my life. There has been brought only one side of this great industrial question, only the method and only the tactics, but what about the ethical part of the question? What about the better and nobler humanity, where there shall be no more slaves, where no man will ever be obliged to go on strike in order to obtain 50 cents a week more, where children will not have to starve anymore, where women no more will have to go and prostitute themselves, where at last there will not be any more slaves, any more masters, but just one great family of friends and brothers? They say you are free in this great and wonderful country. I say that politically you are, and my best compliments and congratulations. But I say you cannot be half free and half slave. And economically, all the working class in the United States are as much slaves now as the Negroes were 40 and 50 years ago. Because the man that owns the tool where another man works, the man that owns the house where this man lives, the man that owns the factory where this man wants to go to work, that man owns and controls the bread that that man eats, and therefore owns and controls his mind, his body, his heart, and his soul. I am 29 years old. Not quite. I have a woman that loves me and that I love. I have a mother and father that are waiting for me. I have an ideal that is dear to me that can be expressed or understood. And life has so many allurements, and it is so nice and so bright and so wonderful that I felt the passion of living in my heart, and I do want to live. Whichever way you judge, gentlemen of the jury, I thank you.
In the year 1914, 1,000 miners with wives and children who had gone on strike against the Rockefeller-owned coal mines in southern Colorado were holding out in a tent colony near the tiny hamlet of Ludlow. One day in April, the National Guard, financed by Rockefeller, began pouring machine gun fire into the tent colony and then came down from the hills and set fire to the tents. The next day, the bodies of 11 children and 2 women were found, suffocated, burned to death. This became known as the Ludlow Massacre. Mother Mary Jones, 82-year-old organizer for the mine workers, had come to Colorado to support the miners. And on the eve of their strike, as they gathered in the opera house in Trinidad, she spoke to them.
What would the coal in the mines be worth if you did not work to take it out? The time is ripe for you to stand like men. I know something about strikes. I didn't go into them yesterday. I was carried 84 miles and landed in jail by a United States Marshal in the night because I was talking to a miners' meeting. The next morning I was brought to court, and the judge said to me, "Did you read my injunction? Did you understand that the injunction told you not to look at the miners? As long as the judge who is higher than you leaves me sight, I will look at anything I want to," said I. The old judge died soon after that, and the injunction died with him. At another time, when in the courtroom, the bailiff said to me, "When you are addressing the court, you must say your honor." "I don't know whether he has any or not," said I. Someone said to me, "You don't believe in charity work, mother?" "No, I don't believe in charity. It is a vice. We need the upbuilding of justice to mankind. We don't need your charity. All we need is an opportunity to live like men and women in this country. I want you to pledge yourselves in this convention to stand as one solid army against the foes of human labor. Think of the thousands who are killed every day, and there is no redress for it. We will fight until the mines are made secure and human life valued more than props. Look things in the face. Don't fear a governor. Don't fear anybody. You pay the governor. He has a right to protect you. You are the biggest part of this population, the biggest part of the population in this state. You create its wealth. So I say, let the fight go on. If anybody else, nobody else will keep on. I will."
That was Alfre Woodard reading the words of labor activist Mother Jones as part of a live reading of Howard Zinn's Voices of a People's History of the United States, the event organized with Anthony Arnov. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Nicole Salazar, Sarah Nasser, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, and Safwat Nazal. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Carl Marxer, Dennis Moynihan, David Prue, Dennis McCormick, Maddie Ely, Anna Osbeck, Emily Anderson, Dante Torrieri, and Buffy St. Marie Hernandez. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU Burnaby.
Listen to Home of Burnaby Rock, CJSF's Lux Rock Electronic Show. 2 hours of relative power each and every Friday, 6 to 8 p.m., and repeats every Thursday, 10 to midnight, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM. Do it.